Main Street by Sinclair Lewis. Chapter 10. The house was haunted long before evening. Shadows slipped down the walls and waited behind every chair. Did that door move? No. She wouldn't go to the Jolly 17. She hadn't energy enough to caper before them to smile blandly at Juanita's rudeness. Not today. But she did want a party. Now. If someone would come in this afternoon, someone who liked her, Vida, or Mrs. Sam Clark, or old Mrs. Champ Perry, or gentle Mrs. Dr. Westlake, or Guy Pollock. She'd telephone. No, that wouldn't be it. They must come of themselves. Perhaps they would. Why not? She'd have tea ready anyway. If they came, splendid. If not, what did she care? She wasn't going to yield to the village and let down. She was going to keep up a belief in the rite of tea, to which she had always looked forward to as the symbol of a leisurely, fine existence. And it would be just as much fun, even if it was so babyish, to have tea by herself and pretend that she was entertaining clever men. It would. She turned the shining thought into action. She bustled to the kitchen, stoked the wood range, sang Schumann while she boiled the kettle, warmed up raisin cookies on a newspaper spread on the rack in the oven. She scampered upstairs to bring down her filmiest tea cloth. She arranged a silver tray. She proudly carried it into the living room and set it on the long cherrywood table, pushing aside a hoop of embroidery, a volume of Conrad from the library, copies of the Saturday Evening Post, the Literary Digest, and Kennicott's National Geographic magazine. She moved the tray back and forth and regarded the effect. She shook her head. She busily unfolded the sewing table, set it in the bay window, patted the tea cloth to smoothness, moved the tray. "Sometime I'll have a mahogany tea table," she said happily. She had brought in two cups, two plates, for herself a straight chair, but for the guest the big wing chair, which she pantingly tugged to the table. She had finished all the preparation she could think of. She sat and waited. She listened for the doorbell, the telephone. Her eagerness was stilled. Her hands drooped. Surely Vida Sherwin would hear the summons. She glanced through the bay window. Snow was sifting over the ridge of the Howland house like sprays of water from a hose. The wide yards across the street were gray with moving eddies. The black trees shivered. The roadway was gashed with ruts of ice. She looked at the extra cup and plate. She looked at the wing chair. It was so empty. The tea was cold in the pot. With wearily dipping fingertip, she tested it. Yes, quite cold. She couldn't wait any longer. The cup across from her was icily clean, glisteningly empty. Simply absurd to wait. She poured her own cup of tea. She sat and stared at it. What was it she was going to do now? Oh, yes, how idiotic. Take a lump of sugar. She didn't want the beastly tea. She was springing up. She was on the couch, sobbing. She was thinking more sharply than she had for weeks. She reverted to her resolution to change the town, awaken it, prod it, reform it. What if they were wolves instead of lambs? They'd eat her all the sooner if she was meek to them. Fight or be eaten. It was easier to change the town completely than to conciliate it. She could not take their point of view. It was a negative thing, an intellectual squalor, a swamp of prejudices and fears. She would have to make them take hers. She was not a Vincent de Paul to govern and mold a people. What of that? The tiniest change in their distrust of beauty would be the beginning of the end, a seed to sprout and some day, with thickening roots, to crack their wall of mediocrity. If she could not, as she desired, do a great thing nobly and with laughter, yet she need not be content with village nothingness. She would plant one seed in the blank wall. Was she just? Was it merely a blank wall, this town, which to 3,000 more people was the center of the universe? Hadn't she, returning from Lacrimere, felt the heartiness of the greetings? No. The 10,000 Gopher Prairies had no monopoly of greetings and friendly hands. Sam Clark was no more loyal than girl librarians she knew in St. Paul, the people she had met in Chicago. And those others had so much that Gopher Prairie complacently lacked. The world of gaiety and adventure, of music, and the integrity of bronze, of remembered mists from tropic isles and Paris nights, and the walls of Baghdad, of industrial justice and a God who spake not in doggerel hymns. One seed. Which seed it was did not matter. All knowledge and freedom were one. But she had delayed so long in finding that seed. Could she do something with this Thanatopsis Club? Or should she make her house so charming that it would be an influence? She'd make Kennicott like poetry. That was it, for a beginning. She conceived so clear a picture of their bending over large, fair pages by the fire, in a non-existent fireplace, that the spectral presences slipped away. Doors no longer moved. Curtains were not creeping shadows, but lovely, dark masses in the dusk. And when Bea came home, Carol was singing at the piano, which she had not touched for many days. Their supper was the feast of two girls. Carol was in the dining room in a frock of black satin edged with gold, and Bea in blue gingham and an apron dined in the kitchen. But the door was open between, and Carol was inquiring, "Did you see any ducks in Doll's window?" And Bea chanting, "No, ma'am." "Say, we have a swell time this afternoon. Tina, she have coffee and knuckle-broad, and her fella was there, and we just laughed and laughed, and the fella say he was president, and he going to make me queen of Finland. And I stick a feather in my hair and say, I been going to go to war. Oh, we was so foolish, and we laugh so." When Carol sat at the piano again, she did not think of her husband, but of the book-drugged hermit, Guy Pollock. She wished that Pollock would come calling. If a girl really kissed him, he'd creep out of his den and be human. If Will were as literate as Guy, or Guy were as executive as Will, I think I could endure even Gopher Prairie. It's so hard to mother Will. I could be maternal with Guy. Is that what I want? Something to mother? A man or a baby or a town? I will have a baby. Some day. But to have him isolated here all his receptive years. And so to bed. Have I found my real level in Bea and kitchen gossip? Oh, I do miss you, Will. But it will be pleasant to turn over in bed as often as I want to without worrying about waking you up. Am I really this settled thing called a married woman? I feel so unmarried tonight, so free. To think that there was once a Mrs. Kennicott who let herself worry over a town called Gopher Prairie when there was a whole world outside it. Of course, Will is going to like poetry. A black February day. Clouds hewn of ponderous timber weighing down on the earth. An irresolute dropping of snow specks upon the trampled wastes. Gloom, but no veiling of angularity. The lines of roofs and sidewalks sharp and inescapable. The second day of Kennicott's absence. She fled from the creepy house for a walk. It was 30 below zero, too cold to exhilarate her. In the spaces between houses the wind caught her. It stung. It gnawed at nose and ears and aching cheeks, and she hastened from shelter to shelter, catching her breath in the lee of a barn, grateful for the protection of a billboard covered with ragged posters showing layer under layer of paste-smeared green and streaky red. The grove of oaks at the end of the street suggested Indians hunting. Snowshoes, and she struggled past the earth-banked cottages to the open country, to a farm and a low hill corrugated with hard snow. In her loose nutria coat, seal toque, virginal cheeks unmarked by lines of village jealousies, she was as out of place on this dreary hillside as a scarlet tanager on an ice floe. She looked down on Gopher Prairie. The snow, stretching without break from streets to devouring prairie beyond, wiped out the town's pretense of being a shelter. The houses were black specks on a white sheet. Her heart shivered with that still loneliness as her body shivered with the wind. She ran back into the huddle of streets, all the while protesting that she wanted a city's yellow glare of shop windows and restaurants, or the primitive forest with hooded firs and a rifle, or a barnyard warm and steamy, noisy with hens and cattle. Certainly not these dun houses, these yards choked with winter ash piles, these roads of dirty snow and clotted, frozen mud. The zest of winter was gone. 3 months more till May, the cold might drag on, with the snow even filthier, the weakened body less resistant. She wondered why the good citizens insisted on adding the chill of prejudice, why they did not make the houses of their spirits more warm and frivolous, like the wise chatterers of Stockholm and Moscow. She circled the outskirts of the town and viewed the slum of Swede Hollow. Wherever as many as 3 houses are gathered, there will be a slum of at least 1 house. In Gopher Prairie, the Sam Clarks boasted, "You don't get any of this poverty that you find in cities. Always plenty of work. No need of charity. Man got to be blamed shiftless if he don't get ahead." But now that the summer mask of leaves and grass was gone, Carol discovered misery and dead hope. In a shack of thin boards covered with tar paper, she saw the washerwoman, Mrs. Steinoff, working in gray steam. Outside, her 6-year-old boy chopped wood. He had a torn jacket, muffler of a blue like skimmed milk. His hands were covered with red mittens, through which protruded his chapped raw knuckles. He halted to blow on them, to cry disinterestedly. A family of recently arrived Finns were camped in an abandoned stable. A man of 80 was picking up lumps of coal along the railroad. She did not know what to do about it. She felt that these independent citizens who had been taught that they belonged to a democracy would resent her trying to play Lady Bountiful. She lost her loneliness in the activity of the village industries, the railroad yards with a freight train switching, the wheat elevator, oil tanks, a slaughterhouse with blood marks on the snow, the creamery with the sleds of farmers and piles of milk cans, an unexplained stone hut labeled Danger, powder stored here. The Jolly Tombstone Yard, where a utilitarian sculptor in a red calfskin overcoat whistled as he hammered the shiniest of granite headstones. Jackson Elder's small planing mill with the smell of fresh pine shavings and the burr of circular saws. Most important, the Gopher Prairie Flour and Milling Company, Lyman Cass, president. Its windows were blanketed with flour dust, but it was the most stirring spot in town. Workmen were wheeling barrels of flour into a boxcar. A farmer sitting on sacks of wheat in a bobsled argued with the wheat buyer. Machinery within the mill boomed and whined, water gurgled in the ice-freed mill race. The clatter was a relief to Carol after months of smug houses. She wished that she could work in the mill, that she did not belong to the caste of professional man's wife. She started for home through the small slum. Before a tar-paper shack at a gateless gate, a man in rough brown dogskin coat and black plush cap with lappets was watching her. His square face was confident. His foxy mustache was picaresque. He stood erect, his hands in his side pockets, his pipe puffing slowly. He was 45 or 6, perhaps. "How do, Mrs. Kennicott?" he drawled. She recalled him, the town handyman who had repaired their furnace at the beginning of winter. "Oh, how do you do?" she fluttered. "My name's Bjornstam, the Red Swede, they call me, remember? Always thought I'd kind of like to say howdy to you again."
Yes, I've been exploring the outskirts of town."
"Yup, fine mess. No sewage, no street cleaning, and the Lutheran minister and the priest represent the arts and sciences. Well, Thunder, we submerged 10th down here in Sweet Hollow are no worse off than you folks. Thank God we don't have to go and purr at Wannity Haydock at the jolly old 17.
The Carol, who regarded herself as completely adaptable, was uncomfortable at being chosen as comrade by a pipe-reeking odd-job man. Probably he was one of her husband's patients, but she must keep her dignity.
"Yes, even the Jolly 17 isn't always so exciting.
It's very cold again today, isn't it?"
"Well..."
Bjornstam was not respectfully valedictory. He showed no signs of pulling a forelock. His eyebrows moved as though they had a life of their own. With a subgrin, he went on.
"Maybe I hadn't ought to talk about Mrs. Haydock and her solemn Collie 17 in that fresh way. I suppose I'd be tickled to death if I was invited to sit in with that gang. I'm what they call a pariah, I guess. I'm the town badman, Mrs. Kennicott, town atheist, and I suppose I must be an anarchist, too. Everybody who doesn't love the bankers and the grand old Republican Party is an anarchist."
Carol had unconsciously slipped from her attitude of departure into an attitude of listening, her face full toward him, her muff lowered. She fumbled.
"Yes, I suppose so."
Her own grudges came in a flood.
"I don't see why you shouldn't criticize the Jolly 17 if you want to. They aren't sacred."
"Oh, yes, they are. The dollar sign has chased the crucifix clean off the map. But then I've got no kick. I do what I please, and suppose I ought to let them do the same."
"What do you mean by saying you're a pariah?"
"I'm poor, and yet I don't decently envy the rich. I'm an old batch. I make enough money for a steak, and then I sit around by myself and shake hands with myself, and have a smoke, and read history, and I don't contribute to the wealth of Brother Elder or Daddy Cass."
I fancy you read a good deal."
"Yep, in the hit or miss way. I'll tell you, I'm a lone wolf. I trade horses and saw wood, and work in lumber camps. I'm a first-rate swamper. Always wished I could go to college, though I suppose I'd find it pretty slow, and they'd probably kick me out."
"You really are a curious person, Mr.
Bjornstam. Miles Bjornstam, half Yank and half Swede, usually known as that damn lazy big-mouth calamity howler that ain't satisfied with the way we run things. No, I ain't curious, whatever you mean by that. I'm just a bookworm. Probably too much reading for the amount of digestion I've got. Probably half-baked. I'm going to get in half-baked first and beat you to it, because it's dead sure to be handed to a radical that wears jeans."
They grinned together. She demanded,
"You say that the Jolly 17 is stupid. What makes you think so?"
"Oh, thrust us borers into the foundation to know about your leisure class.
Fact, Mrs. Kennicott, I'll say that, far as I can make out, the only people in this man's town that do have any brains, I don't mean ledger-keeping brains or duck-hunting brains or baby-spanking brains, but real imaginative brains, are you and me and Guy Pollock and the foreman at the flour mill. He's a socialist, the foreman. Don't tell Lim Cass that. Lim would fire a socialist quicker than he would a horse thief.
Oh, indeed, no. I shan't tell him.
This foreman and I have some great set-tos. He's a regular old-line party member, too dogmatic, expects to reform everything from deforestation to nosebleed by saying phrases like surplus value, like reading the prayer book. But same time, he's a Plato J. Aristotle compared with people like Esri Stowbody or Professor Mott or Julius Flickerbaugh.
It's interesting to hear about him.
He dug his toe into a drift like a schoolboy. Rats, you mean I talk too much? Well, I do, when I get hold of somebody like you. You probably want to run along and keep your nose from freezing.
Yes, I must go, I suppose. But tell me, why did you leave Miss Sherwin of the high school out of your list of the town intelligentsia?
I guess maybe she does belong in it. From all I can hear, she's in everything and behind everything that looks like a reform, a lot more than most folks realize. She lets Mrs. Reverend Warren, the president of this here Thanatopsis Club, think she's running the works, but Miss Sherwin is the secret boss and nags all the easy-going dames into doing something. But the way I figure it out, you see, I'm not interested in these dinky reforms. Miss Sherwin's trying to repair the holes in this barnacle-covered ship of a town by keeping busy bailing out the water, and Pollock tries to repair it by reading poetry to the crew. Me, I want to yank it up on the ways and fire the poor bum of a shoemaker that built it so it sails crooked and have it rebuilt right from the keel up.
Yes, that would be better. But I must run home. My poor nose is nearly frozen.
Say, you'd better come in and get warm and see what an old bachelor's shack is like.
She looked doubtfully at him, at the low shanty, the yard that was littered with cordwood, moldy planks, a hoopless washtub. She was disquieted. But Bjornstam did not give her the opportunity to be delicate. He flung out his hand in a welcoming gesture which assumed that she was her own counselor, that she was not a respectable married woman, but fully a human being. With a shaky, "Well, just a moment to warm my nose," she glanced down the street to make sure that she was not spied on, and bolted toward the shanty. She remained for 1 hour, and never had she known a more considerate host than the Red Swede. He had but one room, bare pine floor, small workbench, wall bunk with amazingly neat bed, frying pan and ash-stippled coffee pot on the shelf behind the pot-bellied cannonball stove, backwoods chairs, one constructed from half a barrel, one from a tilted plank, and a row of books incredibly assorted. Byron and Tennyson and Stevenson, a manual of gas engines, a book by Thorstein Veblen, and a spotty treatise on the care, feeding, diseases, and breeding of poultry and cattle. There was but one picture, a magazine-colored plate of a steep-roofed village in the Harz Mountains, which suggested kobolds and maidens with golden hair. Bjornstam did not fuss over her. He suggested, "Might throw open your coat and put your feet up on the box in front of the stove." He tossed his dogskin coat into the bunk, lowered himself into the barrel chair, and droned on. "Yeah, I'm probably a yahoo, but by gum, I do keep my independence by doing odd jobs, and that's more than these polite cusses like the clerks in the banks do. When I'm rude to some slob, it may be partly because I don't know better, and God knows I'm not no authority on trick forks and what pants you wear with a Prince Albert. But mostly it's because I mean something. I'm about the only man in Johnson County that remembers the joker in the Declaration of Independence about Americans being supposed to have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I meet old Ezra Stowbody on the street. He looks at me like he wants me to remember he's a high muck-a-muck and worth $200,000, and he says, Bjornquist. Bjorn stems my name, Ezra, I says. He knows my name all righty. Well, whatever your name is, he says, I understand you have a gasoline saw. I want you to come round and saw up 4 cords of maple for me. So you like my looks, eh? I says, kind of innocent. What difference does that make? Want you to saw that wood before Saturday, he says, real sharp. Common workmen going and getting fresh with a fifth of $1,000,000 all walking round in a hand-me-down fur coat. Here's the difference it makes, I says, just to devil him. How do you know I like your looks? Maybe he didn't look sore. Nope, I says, thinking it all over. I don't like your application for a loan.
"Take it to another bank, only there ain't any," I says, and I walks off on him. Sure, probably I was surly and foolish, but I figured there had to be one man in town independent enough to sass the banker.
He hitched out of his chair, made coffee, gave Carol a cup and talked on, half defiant and half apologetic, half wistful for friendliness and half amused by her surprise at the discovery that there was a proletarian philosophy. At the door, she hinted,
"Mr. Bjornstam, if you were I, would you worry when people thought you were affected?"
"Huh? Kick him in the face. Say, if I were a seagull, and all over silver, think I'd care what the pack of dirty seals thought about my flying?"
It was not the wind at her back. It was the thrust of Bjornstam's scorn which carried her through town. She faced Juanita Haydock, cocked her head at Maud Dyer's brief nod, and came home to be radiant. She telephoned Vida Sherwin to run over this evening. She lustily played Tchaikovsky, the virile chords an echo of the red, laughing philosopher of the tar-paper shack. When she hinted to Vida, "Isn't there a man here who amuses himself by being irreverent to the village gods? Bjornstam, some such name?" the reform leader said,
"Bjornstam? Oh, yes, fixes things. He's awfully impertinent."
Kennicott had returned at midnight. At breakfast he said four times that he had missed her every moment. On her way to market, Sam Clark hailed her.
"The top of the morning to yez. Going to stop and pass the time of day at Sam O'Warma, eh? What'd the doc's thermometer say it was? Say, you folks better come round and visit with us one of these evenings. Don't be so doggone proud, stand by yourselves."
Champ Perry, the pioneer wheat buyer at the elevator, stopped her in the post office, held her hand in his withered paws, peered at her with faded eyes, and chuckled.
"You are so fresh and blooming, my dear. Mother was saying t'other day that a sight of you was better than a dose of medicine."
In the Bon Ton store, she found Guy Pollock tentatively buying a modest gray scarf.
"We haven't seen you for so long," she said. "Wouldn't you like to come in and play cribbage some evening?"
As though he meant it, Pollock begged.
"May I? Really?"
While she was purchasing 2 yards of malines, the vocal Ramey Wotherspoon tiptoed up to her, his long, sallow face bobbing, and he besought,
"You've just got to come back to my department and see a pair of patent leather slippers I set aside for you."
In a manner of more than sacerdotal reverence, he unlaced her boots, tucked her skirt about her ankles, slid on the slippers. She took them.
"You're a good salesman," she said.
"Oh, I'm not a salesman at all, eh? Just like elegant things. All this is so inartistic,"
he indicated with a forlornly waving hand, the shelves of shoe boxes, the seat of thin wood perforated in rosettes, the display of shoe trees and tin boxes of blacking, the lithograph of a smirking young woman with cheery cheeks who proclaimed in the exalted poetry of advertising,
"My tootsies never got hep to what pedal perfection was till I got a pair of clever, classy Cleopatra shoes."
"But sometimes," Ramey sighed, "there is a pair of dainty little shoes like these, and I set them aside for someone who will appreciate. When I saw these, I said right away, 'Wouldn't it be nice if they fitted Mrs. Kennicott?' And I meant to speak to you first chance I had. I haven't forgotten our jolly talks at Mrs. Gurry's."
That evening, Guy Pollock came in, and, though Kennicott instantly impressed him into a cribbage game, Carol was happy again. She did not, in recovering something of her buoyancy, forget her determination to begin the liberalizing of Gopher Prairie by the easy and agreeable propaganda of teaching Kennicott to enjoy reading poetry in the lamplight. The campaign was delayed. Twice he suggested that they call on neighbors, once he was in the country. The fourth evening he yawned pleasantly, stretched, and inquired,
"Well, what'll we do tonight? Shall we go to the movies?"
"I know exactly what we're going to do. Now, don't ask questions. Come and sit down by the table. There. Are you comfy? Lean back and forget you're a practical man and listen to me."
It may be that she had been influenced by the managerial Vida Sherwin. Certainly she sounded as though she was selling culture. But she dropped it when she sat on the couch, her chin in her hands, a volume of Yeats on her knees, and read aloud. Instantly she was released from the homely comfort of a prairie town. She was in the world of lonely things, the flutter of twilight linnets, the aching call of gulls along a shore to which the netted foam crept out of darkness, the island of Angus, and the elder gods, and the eternal glories that never were, tall kings and women girdled with crusted gold, the woeful incessant chanting, and the
"et cetera,"
coughed Dr. Kennicott. She stopped.
She remembered that he was the sort of person who chewed tobacco. She glared while he uneasily petitioned.
That's great stuff. Study it in college? I like poetry fine. James Whitcomb Riley and some of Longfellow, this Hiawatha. Gosh, I wish I could appreciate that highbrow art stuff. But I guess I'm too old a dog to learn new tricks.
With pity for his bewilderment and a certain desire to giggle, she consoled him.
Then let's try some Tennyson. You've read him.
Tennyson? You bet. Read him in school. There's that, on Let There Be No, what is it, of Farewell, when I put out to sea, but let the... Well, I don't remember all of it, but... Oh, sure. And there's that I met a little country boy who, Gee, I don't remember exactly how it goes, but the chorus ends up, We Are Seven.
Yes. Shall we try The Idylls of the King? They're so full of color.
Go to it. Shoot.
But he hastened to shelter himself behind a cigar. She was not transported to Camelot. She read with an eye cocked on him, and when she saw how much he was suffering, she ran to him, kissed his forehead, cried,
You poor, forced tuberose that wants to be a decent turnip.
Now look here now, that ain't...
Anyway, I shan't torture you any longer.
She could not quite give up. She read Kipling with a great deal of emphasis.
There's a regiment a-comin' down the Grand Trunk Road.
He tapped his foot to the rhythm. He looked normal and reassured, but when he complimented her,
That was fine. I don't know but what you can elocute just as good as Ella Stowbody.
She banged the book and suggested that they were not too late for the 9 o'clock show at the movies. This was her last effort to harvest the April wind, to teach divine unhappiness by a correspondence course, to buy the lilies of Avalon and the sunsets of cocaine in tin cans at Ollie Jensen's grocery. But the fact is that, at the motion pictures, she discovered herself laughing as heartily as Kennicott at the humor of an actor who stuffed spaghetti down a woman's evening frock. For a second she loathed her laughter, mourned for the day when on her hill by the Mississippi she had walked the battlements with queens. But the celebrated cinema jester's conceit of dropping toads into a soup plate flung her into unwilling tittering, and the afterglow faded, the dead queens fled through darkness. She went to the Jolly Seventeen's afternoon bridge. She had learned the elements of the game from the Sam Clarks. She played quietly and reasonably badly. She had no opinions on anything more polemic than woolen union suits, a topic on which Mrs. Howland discoursed for 5 minutes. She smiled frequently and was the complete canary bird in her manner of thanking the hostess, Mrs. Dave Dyer. Her only anxious period was during the conference on husbands. The young matrons discussed the intimacies of domesticity with a frankness and a minuteness which dismayed Carol. Juanita Haydock communicated Harry's method of shaving and his interest in deer-shooting. Mrs. Gaugerling reported fully and with some irritation her husband's inappreciation of liver and bacon. Maud Dyer chronicled Dave's digestive disorders, quoted a recent bedtime controversy with him in regard to Christian Science, socks, and the sewing of buttons upon vests, announced that she simply wasn't going to stand his always pawing girls when he went and got crazy jealous if a man just danced with her, and rather more than sketched Dave's variety of kisses. So meekly did Carol give attention, so obviously was she at last desirous of being one of them, that they looked on her fondly, and encouraged her to give such details of her honeymoon as might be of interest. She was embarrassed rather than resentful. She deliberately misunderstood. She talked of Kennicott's overshoes and medical ideals till they were thoroughly bored. They regarded her as agreeable, but green. Till the end she labored to satisfy the Inquisition. She bubbled at Juanita, the president of the club, that she wanted to entertain them. Only, she said, I don't know that I can give you any refreshments as nice as Mrs. Dyer's salad, or that simply delicious angel's food we had at your house, dear.
Well, fine. We need a hostess for the 17th of March. Wouldn't it be awfully original if you made it a St. Patrick's Day bridge? I'll be tickled to death to help you with it. I'm glad you've learned to play bridge. At first I didn't hardly know if you were going to like Gopher Prairie. Isn't it dandy that you've settled down to being homey with us? Maybe we aren't as highbrow as the cities, but we do have the daisiest times, and, oh, we go swimming in summer, and dances, and, oh, lots of good times. If folks will just take us as we are, I think we're a pretty good bunch.
I'm sure of it. Thank you so much for the idea about having a St. Patrick's Day bridge.
Oh, that's nothing. I always think the Jolly Seventeen are so good at original ideas. If you knew these other towns, Wachemin and Geraliman and all, you'd find out and realize that G.P. is the liveliest, smartest town in the state. Did you know that Percy Bresnahan, the famous auto manufacturer, came from here, and... Yes, I think that a St. Patrick's Day party would be awfully cunning and original, and yet not too queer or freaky or anything.
The end of Chapter 10 of Main Street by Sinclair Lewis. Read by Rick Kishner for Let to Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.